So my story goes as follows. I grew up in Greece, so don't get confused by my British accent. I had two brothers, two stepbrothers, no sisters. And when I was in 10th grade, I flunked science and math, and I went to an all-boys school. So you may be wondering, why is this guy here to talk to us about technology and science and women? Although my childhood was the furthest from all of these topics. So I applied to Tufts Early Decision and came to the engineering school here in 1980 as a freshman. And as you can imagine, a lot of things surprised me when I came for the first time to this country. One of the things that surprised me was how little people understood about what engineers do. In Europe, engineering is one of the most prestigious professions, as many of you know. The smartest kids tend to go to engineering and to medical school, and in most European countries, you can enter medical school right out of high school. And actually, the most difficult department to get into in Greece is ocean engineering. It's like the most difficult department to get in. So when I came here, I assumed everybody knows what engineers are and admires engineers. And I realized that people use the word engineering to describe people that drive trains, repair VCRs, do all sorts of things that are not quite engineering. Actually, and I started building a passion about that. And last month, my wife and I were on a vacation with our kids. And we were in a hotel. We came to the hotel room. And my daughter noticed that the toilet was clogged. And so she asked us to call service. So my wife called service, and the service desk tells her, "Oh, we'll send the engineer right up." You know, so my wife was like, "Ha, you know, the engineer's gonna come and clog the toilet."
She said, "We've got one already."
Yeah, I couldn't do that. So, early on, I started building a passion to figure out a way to get people know in this country what engineers do, and hopefully do it in a way that would be attractive to kids considering careers in engineering. So I studied at Tufts, and I went to graduate school, then I came back to Tufts. In my first research project, and some of you are too young to remember, but some of you may remember, back in the mid-'80s, the Zurich-based IBM researchers made a big discovery, at least what we thought was a big discovery. They discovered a new kind of superconducting materials. These are materials that, if you lower their temperature at a certain point, they lose all their electrical resistance. Now, why was that significant? Because it was our hope that we could make materials like that operate at room temperature. And why is that significant? Well, if you have materials with no electrical resistance operating at room temperature, you could generate electricity right where you extract the oil and transport it throughout the world with no losses, which is a fantastic possibility. Or one of the limitations of having very, very small computers is not that we cannot put circuits close to each other, is they generate a lot of heat because of the electrical resistance. So you need a fan. That's what the noise inside of your computer is. And if we could make circuits with no electrical resistance, then we could have very, very small computers. And the other magical property of these materials was that if you put a magnet on top of them, strong enough magnet, the magnet floats up in the air like magic. The magnet basically sees a magnetic mirror image of itself. So why would that be significant? Well, we could have roads made from these materials and have cars zooming like the Jetsons, you know, around. So a lot of us dropped the research we're doing and jumped into this field, thinking the world will be different. We can change the world in a spectacular time. Thousands of people packed in small rooms in conferences, exchanging ideas. So, of course, I jumped on the bandwagon, and I put together a team, which we call the Super Team for superconductors. There was 11 brilliant juniors, actually, at Tufts. And we made these materials that were not that difficult to make. Of course, they were running at liquid nitrogen temperature. And we're trying to make thin films from these materials. And we're doing pretty well. So my wife and I bought our first house at the western suburb. We didn't have any kids then. It was about 25 miles from here. And as everybody does when they buy a new house, they're trying to find a better way to get to work. So there's shortcuts. So on my way to Tufts, I made a mistake. And instead of taking a left turn, I took a right turn. And I ended up at a dead end, which happened to be the middle school parking lot, the town middle school parking lot. So as I was looping around to get out, I thought, we made these cool materials in the lab. Maybe the kids in the school would like to see them. So I got out of the car, and I went and told I went and met the principal, who was a nice guy, and I told him I'm a faculty member at Tufts, I'm a new resident, and we made these cool materials. You dip them in liquid nitrogen, the magnet floats up in the air. It's a great way to show kids some physics concepts. So he called down the eighth grade science teacher, who was a very nice older gentleman, who invited me to give a presentation the following Friday to his eighth grade class. So it was exciting for me because I'd never taught kids at that age, and actually had never been in a co-ed school because I grew up in an all-boys school in Greece. So I worked with my students to make a lot of hands-on activities so that the kids would understand the physics behind the superconductor. It wouldn't be just the gee whiz, the magnet floats, and then they wouldn't understand how it works. So here I am the following Friday giving my spiel and my presentations, and I was doing demos, and there was a little girl that was sitting, a little blonde girl with frizzy hair. She was sitting front row. She was taking notes. She was glued to everything I had to say. So as an example to help the kids understand the concept of electrical resistance, I had them imagine drinking a milkshake out of a straw. The thicker the straw, the easier to drink the milkshake. The thicker the wire, the easier for the electricity to flow through. Or the longer the straw, the more difficult to drink the milkshake. The longer the wire, the higher the resistance. At the end of the talk, I noticed that the science teacher was grouping three boys together, and these boys were introduced to me before my talk as the science boys, so they were coming toward me. As they're coming toward me, the little blonde girl gets up, sees them coming toward me, cuts right in front of them, and she says, Dr. Miaoulis, could you help me with my science fair project? Now, I had not signed up for any science fair projects. I wanted to give a talk and get out of there, you know. But I wanted to be polite. So as I started talking with her, the teacher comes and pulls me aside and whispers into my ear, don't waste your time with her. She's a mediocre student. Work with my science boys. And I just couldn't believe that a teacher would say that. I mean, the little girl was brave enough to come to this guy with an accent that she didn't know, and, you know, and asked to do stuff, and that's what the guy said. Well, that particular moment is the reason why I'm at the Museum of Science today. Because what started, I never thought I would work in K-12. I had my happy research and happy teaching at Tufts, and I was fine. But that's what started my activities in that school. So I started working to try to improve the science program in the school. And then I started working with other schools. I pulled some of my colleagues into the K-12 outreach business. We started getting large grants. The grants became very large, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And then I became dean of the school in the early 90s, and I could sort of call the shots as much as a dean can call the shots. And it became a big sort of effort of the School of Engineering. It was, you know, three research areas, and science outreach was a major activity of the School of Engineering. It was a big part of the budget. We're getting multi-million dollar grants at that point. But we're doing the traditional science outreach, you know, teaching the physical sciences and the life sciences in better ways, working with teachers, doing curriculum development and all that. So it was 1995, and we had invited for lunch a major donor. And we wanted to ask him for a major gift to endow the program. And he was a renowned engineer, a brilliant guy. So we made the pitch, and Chris Rogers, who's still at Tufts, a colleague of mine, basically was making the case how science is a very important discipline in K-12 because this is the discipline that teaches the kids about the world around them, understanding how the world around you works and how you go about discovering the world around. So in the middle of the lunch, the guy gets up, the donor, bangs his hand on the table, and says, you're wasting my time. And we panic. The guy was difficult to start with, but we didn't think that he would just leave in the middle of the lunch. And Chris goes, why? He said, you think really that science teaches the kids about the world around them? And Chris says, sure. He said, you're kidding yourself. And he gets up and leaves in the middle of the lunch. Panic in the room. You can imagine now. We lost a big donor. We were almost sure we're going to get the $5 million. So that night, we went out with Chris for dinner and drinks. and to figure out what had happened. And then we played back the conversation. And we played back his words. And we realized, we looked around us, that actually science does not teach kids about the world around. And let's do a simple exercise, okay? In science, what do we learn in science? If you think back on your K-12 curriculum, you learn about rocks and dinosaurs and the rainforest and the human body and physics principles and chemical reactions, and you know the curriculum, okay? It's almost 100% focuses on the natural world. Okay, the natural world. Now, side of the natural world, we have the human-made world. Okay, so let's do a little exercise. Let's think of how this meeting would look here right now if we took the human-made world out of the picture. What would not be here? Not your thinking. What would not be here? Who's going to go first? The building wouldn't be here. What else? Sitting on the ground. In mud, because there wouldn't be all the infrastructure that went in with.
Clothing.
Clothing. Yeah, that usually comes up first. You know. It depends. It depends on the group. You know. What else wouldn't be here? And you know, most of us, actually a lot of young people here, but most of us wouldn't be here, because if it weren't for pharmaceuticals, the life expectancy was 27. Okay, so if you think the human-made world is not part of the curriculum, okay, it's natural world. If you take that out, there's very little left that's relevant to our lives, other than our own body, if we're still alive. Okay, so when we realized that people that set this whole science up missed 98% of the picture of what's covered, then we got very curious. How come, with all these brilliant people in science education, in teaching professions, departments of education, how have they missed the point? Focusing the kids on 2% of the world around them and leaving out the 98% of the experience. And here's what we found out. The topics that we teach in science today were decided somewhere here at Harvard by the Committee of Ten, chaired by President Eliot in 1893. Okay, fact. And what they did, the Committee of Ten did something brilliant. Actually, they used a rational process. They look what kids learn at home, what they need to know when they graduate from high school, and they figured we'll teach the rest at school, rational. So biology came into play, and chemistry, and earth science, and all the traditional disciplines, because you don't do earth science at home or biology at home. So why did they leave technology out, the human-made world? Well, back in 1893, 90% of Massachusetts residents, or close to that, were farmers. So technology was primarily farm technology, agricultural technology. And that part of the technology was happening at home, of the education was happening at home. So there was no need for a separate discipline, technology or the human-made world, at schools, because kids were learning how the machines and everything are at home. So they left the human-made world out of the curriculum. And here's what happened. After they published the report, publishers jumped in and started developing books to cover the disciplines. And because technology was not part of the curriculum, they left this whole discipline out. And as technology took off, the curriculum hasn't changed, because curriculum doesn't change that often. And here we have reached the point where you're considered illiterate if you don't know how many legs a grasshopper has, but it's perfectly fine if you are clueless about how you drive this thing to the gas station, you open a hole, you put liquid inside, and this thing takes you places. It's perfectly fine if you have no clue, okay? But God forbid you don't know how many legs a grasshopper has, okay? Or how a mica rock is structured. So when we realized that, we thought we have a bigger problem than we thought. We have to totally change strategies, and we should really be focusing our efforts into introducing the human-made world into the curriculum, along with the natural world. So yes, understanding the natural world is important, because it's a big part of the picture. But also, the bigger part of the picture is understanding the world around us, which is human-made. So, and also, at the same time, you learn as a student how a scientist discovers the inquiry process, kids should learn how an engineer designs, the engineering design process. So they discover the natural world through the inquiry process, and you design the human-made world through the engineering design process. Now, imagine how difficult it is to introduce a new discipline in schools. Somebody has said it's more difficult than moving a graveyard. Okay, it's impossible to introduce a new discipline because they're set in their ways, they have their books, they have their curriculum. So it was a big, big struggle. But we were armed with five arguments of why engineering should be part of the curriculum. First one is technological literacy, understanding 98% of the world around you is basic literacy. You cannot claim you're a literate citizen if you have no clue how this is made, how this is made, how your clothes are made, how your car is made, things that you use every day, you have no clue how they happen. So it's basic literacy. The second argument we had is engineering offers a wonderful way to introduce project-based learning into the classroom and work with kids in a collaborative way, in a team-based way to solve real problems they care about. Even in second grade, you can do engineering. And in second grade, a problem might be, you remember, engineers identify a need and then go through a process to satisfy the need. So in second grade, that particular year, let's say the class had the bunny rabbit as a pet. And one of the children was allergic to the bunny rabbit. So that automatically guides kids into creating a solution which is design and build an outdoor habitat for the bunny rabbit. That's an engineering project for second grade level. But it pulls together the math skills, they have to do all sorts of measurements and calculations, the science skills, heat travels from hot to cold, so you need insulation, art skills to make something that's aesthetically pleasing and matches the environment outside. All the stuff they learn in other disciplines come together, they get pulled together and entice kids to work in teams to solve the problem. So technological literacy is basic literacy. Second argument is project-based learning is great if you use the engineering design process. The third one was actually interesting. Our argument was that engineering makes math and science relevant. Now, believe it or not, the biggest enemy we had on the initiative were the science teachers. And I'll never forget, it was my second big spiel about the initiative. It was late 90s, or like 97, 98. And it was an auditorium filled with teachers. And I was making the pitch about engineering, and in the middle of my talk, a guy gets up and starts screaming at me. And I didn't know it was wrong. I thought the place was on fire, because he just got up. And he said, so I said, what? He said, you are telling us that you want to throw one more thing in our plate to teach. Our plate is so full with everything we have to teach, and you're throwing one more thing. And I said, what grade do you teach, sir? He said, sixth grade. I said, what's your area? Earth science. So I asked him, so what do you teach in earth science? He said, volcanoes. And I said, that's great. So how long do you spend teaching the kids about volcanoes? He said, about a month. And then I couldn't resist asking, so how long do you spend throughout the middle school years teaching the kids how a car works? He said, oh, that's not part of the curriculum. And I couldn't resist again, and I asked him, so how often do your students find themselves in a volcano compared to a car? And why did you spend a month teaching the kids about volcanoes and cars should not be part of the curriculum? By the way, this guy, I see him all the time. He hates my guts. He never talks to me since 98. I see him, he comes to conferences. But that's precisely the point. The curriculum is filled, but filled with what? And by the way, volcanoes offer a wonderful way to teach plate tectonics and the structure of Earth, so I think it's important to have that. But don't tell me that you have a month to teach about volcanoes and no time throughout the middle school years to teach anything about the human-made world. And let me tell you my story with Tufts. We had a problem at Tufts. When I became dean, I discovered that we're losing 22% of the freshman class to liberal arts. And when I looked at the background of the kids that were transferring out, they were transferring out with a GPA of a B+. Their SAT scores were exceeding 1,400, verbal plus math. Their average graduating rank was about 4% from high school. So they were great kids. So I went straight to the previous dean, Fred Nelson. I said, Fred, do you realize that we're losing 22% of the class? He said, well, that's great. I said, what's great? So, well, the average engineering school loses 50% of its class, he said. So I did something brilliant. I asked the kids that were transferring out why they're transferring out. Nobody had asked, you know. So 22% were the best in the country, you know, we're doing fine. So, and here's what they said, which I found interesting. They said that we are transferring out of engineering because we do not find engineering interesting. What I found interesting was that they were transferring out before they had taken any engineering, because freshman engineers take math and science. That's what they take, calculus and physics and chemistry, and maybe a design course, maybe. So I brought together some of my best faculty, and we thought, let's solve the problem. So what do we need? We need to put some good seasoned professors in front of them freshman year, and also have them teach in a passionate way. And what better way, we thought, than teaching in a passionate way than developing courses and delivering courses stemming out of your personal interests and hobbies, like totally out-of-the-box type of courses, not move the statics course from sophomore year into freshman year. So we needed two things. We needed a lot of money, because to get tenured professors to teach freshmen, you need a lot of money and promises and support and graduate students and all that. So we got a big grant from NSF, so we had that. And the second thing we did is we threw the money at them and told them, look at your hobbies and come up with some extraordinary courses. And they did. And to give the good example, I developed two of these courses. My big hobbies, first one is fishing, and the other one is cooking. So my fishing course was called Life in Moving Fluids, and it was a fluid mechanics course, which is, you know, fluid mechanics, the study of how liquids and gases flow and how they interact with solids and all that. And it was a course that, it was a fluid mechanics course, but from the nature's point of view, from a fish's point of view, or from a tree's point of view. So we're doing all sorts of discoveries, and my laboratory looked more like a biology laboratory, actually, than an engineering laboratory. We had fish, and we had wind tunnels with trees and stuff like that. And just to give you an idea of one of my favorite topics we were teaching, you know maple samara seeds? We have them all over here in season that you find them on the ground. They look like little helicopter blades. And, well, it's a perfect example of a life in moving fluid application, because the plant has evolved so that when there is a breeze, the seed would detach and travel a maximum distance from the mother tree using a helicopter motion versus just dropping in the shadow of the tree. So we would study the seeds and do all sort of the mechanics of it, and my class used to be taught right before lunchtime, and from the window of my office I could see thousands of students leaving the big engineering building to go to lunch, and I could tell from far away which ones were my students during the maple samara time, because most students would walk, you know, the typical college walk, you know, like that, and kick the seeds around, and but my students would pull up the seed and throw it in the air and look at the seed. And everybody thought my students were getting stoned in my class, you know. But it was very rewarding to see how they had a totally different lens on nature, because they combined the engineering lens along with the sort of the observers, the scientist lens. My other course stand out of my other hobby, which is cooking. And my course was called Gourmet Engineering. And if you think of what you do when you cook, you pretty much transfer heat from one object to another object. And the art is to not to transfer heat for too long, because then you overcook it. So it's sort of a heat transfer process where you use convection, conduction, radiation, the three modes of heat transfer, depending on how you cook. So, and there's a whole discipline in mechanical engineering called heat transfer. And so it was a heat transfer course, but disguised under cooking thing. So we would have a lecture component where we would solve a traditional heat transfer problem, which would be you have a cylinder with these XY dimensions, and the cylinder has an initial temperature, let's say, of 70 degrees Fahrenheit, and you put it in an environment of 325 Fahrenheit. How long would it take for this point in the cylinder to reach a temperature of 130 degrees? That's a typical heat transfer problem with very difficult math involved. It involves differential equations and things that first-year students, most of them, don't know. So we'd start solving the problem, and then we would get stuck because the kids didn't know enough math, and I would give them the solution. And why would they be interested? Because that particular cylinder happens to be a roast that we're ready to put in the oven in a state-of-the-art kitchen laboratory that we have. Funded by Cafalon and Frigidaire. I had pots and pans. Swear to God. We were on the front, back then, on the front page, on the web page of Cafalon. It was the Tufts Cooking Laboratory. And pots and pans I could never afford to have at home. But they're all there. And we would put, after the lecture, we would go to the lab, we would put the cylinder, the roast, in the oven, and we had put wire thermometers, thermocouples throughout the roast, and we would monitor the temperature, and guess what? At the time we had predicted solving the math, the temperature at that point was pretty much what we had predicted, which brought everything to life. And it's amazing that you have total silence in the lab, everybody looking at the thermometer going up in temperature, which brought the science part of it and the math part of it to life. And you should hear stories after Thanksgiving break when, you know, they went back home and they cooked turkeys and they blinded everybody with science at home, you know, doing the convection and predicting temperatures. Chris Rogers, who is a violinist, designed a course called Design and Performance of Musical Instruments. And it was a course about fluid mechanics and acoustics, again, mechanical engineering. And the kids at the end of the semester, they had to design and build a musical instrument. And there was a concert at the end of each semester. I used to let them use the faculty lounge, which was very plush, and they would come dressed up for the concert, and everything looked beautiful and sounded horrible. Guess what happened after we introduced engineering freshman year? Tufts became, and still is, the only engineering school in the country that more students transfer from liberal arts into engineering than engineering to liberal arts. Because these courses are open to liberal arts majors. And the greatest retention was women and minorities. I have no idea why, but I took full credit. And actually, I do have an idea, in which I'll talk to you, in a moment. So the third motivation of having engineering, it makes math and science relevant. And not only it takes away from math and science, but it lets kids stick with math and science because they see the point of math and science. And that relevance is particularly important for retaining young women in science. Now, if you look at the disciplines that women tend to gravitate, the science disciplines, they are primarily the disciplines where their value and the value added they offer to society is evident. 50% of the medical school students are women. It's not easy getting into medical school, 50% women. Life sciences, majority women. If you look even at the engineering disciplines, biomedical engineering, environmental engineering, lots and lots of women. Okay. One of the most difficult schools to get into in the world, probably, is the Tufts School of Veterinary Medicine. They get thousands of applications for 50 spots, 85% women. Okay. So in the areas where it's obvious you help, in science, women gravitate. Okay. So presenting the relevance of the science and how it helps the world is a big attractor to women. In engineering, done well, because in engineering you identify a human need and you use your science, your math, your imagination, your art to solve the problem. If done well and presented well, will attract more women into engineering and also attract more women or retain more women into the sciences. So this was our third argument. The fourth argument is the one of careers. Okay, there's back and forth debate whether we need more engineers. Some people say yes, some people will say no. I say yes, simply because although we can outsource some stuff, there are some things we simply cannot outsource. For example, people that run the infrastructure. Somebody has to run the electric company, the filtration system for clean water, all that stuff, the roads, the bridges. You cannot outsource that stuff. We need engineers here that can do it. That's a basic level. Then we cannot outsource national security stuff. Would you feel safe if you import your missiles from China and India? Probably not. Okay. So, and these are extremely sophisticated systems, as I'm sure you know. So we need the best minds to work in these kinds of systems. And the third area we cannot outsource, which is very subtle, one of the things that make this country special, that people like me want to come and live here, is the innovation and the ingenuity. And identifying needs that stem out of the society and then using the great brains that are here to design for these needs. And we don't want to lose that. We don't want to import the ingenuity from elsewhere. This country is going to lose its edge, and it's not going to be as fun living here. So for all these reasons, we need to have more engineers and attract brighter kids to go into engineering. And here is the catch. 72% of United States students that became engineers have had a relative that's an engineer. Okay. 72%. Numbers of reasons. Main reason, career guidance about engineering stinks. Okay, so if you're good in math and science, the career guidance counselor tells you go become an actuary. You know, or go become a science teacher, which is good, but it doesn't help the engineering side. And here's the bigger problem. As minority groups become majority groups, we have a big problem even retaining the number of engineers for the following reason. Let's take minority group, current minority group, African Americans. If you look at the traditional areas where African American children choose to go into college, it's education, medicine, and law. Okay, that's a fact. Engineering is not one of them. So in that community, there aren't enough relatives to motivate kids to to go into engineering. They motivate them to go to education, law, and medicine. So as these groups become the majority, we're running out of engineers. If we simply go by 72% of people that went to engineering had relatives, because the relatives aren't there. So unless we have engineering part of the curriculum that all kids, regardless where they come from, have at least an exposure to it, we're not going to have enough engineers even to retain the current levels. And the last reason, which is relevant and closer to the stuff you really worry about the internet, but it's a negative side of the internet, is the following. This used to be a boy-girl issue. Freshman class would come in. In most engineering schools that we were connected with, we were noticing that boys were better than girls in 3D visualization, taking a 3D image and rotating in their minds and redrawing it. So do sort of the sketching, the 3D visualization. And we knew it had nothing to do with genetics, because after the first semester in design, both boys and girls, or young men and young women, would be as good. But we're dead curious why, when they come in, the boys were better than the girls. It was a fact. You give the same test. Kids had graduated from the same high school, same SAT scores, same family sometimes, brother and sister, boys better. End of the semester, same. And we found a study that was done, because this was a universal phenomenon. So other engineering schools were trying to figure out what's going on. There was a study done at Michigan Technological University, I think. They analyzed the whole situation and found out that the reason this happens is because of the different toys that boys and girls play when they grow up. So I was dead curious, and I went to, because my kids were young then, so I didn't have much exposure to that. So I went to Toys R Us. I asked permission, and I took pictures. Whenever you are at a strip mall, go to Toys R Us and take a look. With this in mind, you will be amazed of the differences of toys. Boys' toys. Lincoln Logs, the lathe, Rector sets back then. There was Legos. Girls' toys. My Little Pony, plastic horse with a fuzzy tail and a cone. Try to build visualization skills, combing the tail, you know. Barbie's new challenge. I'm not making it up. Go, Barbie's new challenge, Barbie holding a spatula, okay? So if you have girls for 14 years playing with these toys and boys for 14 years playing with the other toys, how do you expect them to be equal in visualizing and solving problems and doing that? Okay? And now here's the problem. By the time I left Tufts, what was a boy-girl problem had become boy and girl problem. Nobody could design in 3 dimensions. Okay? And here's my theory. If you look at how kids spend their discretionary time now, it's all or in front of a 2D screen. Okay? My space, my face, you know, all that stuff, you know? That's all they do. You know, that's all they do. You know, I have two daughters, two teenage daughters, God save my soul. And I hope they're not watching on the internet. But and you know, have a basement downstairs in our home with a TV and a computer with internet connection. They would happily live down there. You know, you throw them some food in the morning, you know, remove their waste in the afternoon, and life is good. We can talk with 65 friends at the same time, watch our shows, watch the model, whatever you call it, the next model, and talk with the friends. And that's what teenagers do these days. So both boys and girls. So how do you expect them to have this 3D visualization skill, which is not only for the next generation of scientists and engineers, it's a basic life skill. If you cannot visualize things in 3 dimensions, you cannot redo your kitchen. And you should see people in IKEA. I get a laugh at it. They go to IKEA trying to get furniture, and they walk around, young people, they walk around in circles. They cannot figure out how to put stuff together. It's funny to just observe people that have lost this ability to put something all together in 3D. So these were our five arguments. Okay, and then we're looking for a chance to make it happen. And the big chance to introduce engineering in the curriculum came in 1998. Commissioner Driscoll, he just retired, he was a friend, he calls me up and says, Yanis, I would like you to be part of the group that will redo the science standards for Massachusetts. And I thought, well, that's a great opportunity. I said, David, I'll do it, but I really want to put engineering in the science standards. He said, if you can convince the committee of teachers, it's fine. He didn't think it would happen. It took us 2.5 years. Endless meetings, fights, arguments, meeting conferences, and we did it. On December 20th, 2000, Massachusetts became the first state in the country to not only have engineering into the standards, but also put them as part of the MCAS, which is the infamous or famous tests that Massachusetts has at the elementary, middle school, and high school level. So, and we were thrilled because there was no choice whether schools would have engineering. It's part of the MCAS. You got to teach it at some point. Of course, there are other challenges implementing it, and we can talk about it later. So I thought, this is amazing. My dream was to introduce engineering by 2015. I had sort of calculated into every school, into every state. And I thought, we got Massachusetts. This is great. It's going to be a piece of cake to get it implemented in Massachusetts and get everybody else do it. Not. Because it was nationally known, because it had attracted national attention as the Tufts Initiative. Great things for Tufts had happened. We doubled the number of applications to Tufts because of that initiative. The number of women applying to Tufts went up by 26%. SATs improved by 120 points. Okay? Because it was the talk in high schools, and kids were hearing about Tufts and they were applying to Tufts Engineering School because along with everything else was the cooking class, and the buzz was out. Now, this was great for Tufts, but it was not good for the initiative because no other dean wanted to work with me to make it happen nationally because it was a Tufts initiative, and BU wanted to have the BU initiative, and Northeastern, and Northeastern initiative, and MIT, the MIT initiative. We're all friends, but everybody wanted his own initiative. So frustration and was stalled for 2.5 years. The Museum of Science, on the other hand, had discovered that museums also have it wrong. If you look at science museums, they focus up on the natural world, you know, the stuffed animals and the rocks and the physical principles. They leave out the human-made world. So the Museum of Science independently, the board and the staff decided to make technology as a co-equal to science in the Museum of Science. So the same way they present science, the natural world, they present technology. In the same way they present the inquiry process, they present the engineering design process. So in 2002, when David Ellis, my predecessor, decided to retire and they were looking for a new president, a search firm called me up. And I said, I'm calling you from the Museum of Science. Are you interested in its presidency? The Museum of Science, the last thing I thought I was going to do in my life was work for the Museum of Science. I love the Museum of Science. Actually, my wife and I had our first date at the Museum of Science on March 13th, 1982. Not my choice. I wanted to take her to the Hong Kong for scorpion bowls. But that's what my proposal. I still have the email or a version of email. Okay? She said, no, we're going to the Museum of Science. It was a safer place, I guess, for a first date. And so we loved the museum. We had kids. Our daughters were members. We're going every weekend, you know. But I never thought I would work at the place, although I loved it. So to be polite, I asked the search firm, why don't you send me the packet? So they sent me the packet with the job description. And my wife actually read it first. I was finishing cooking, and she had put the kids to bed. And they said, you got to see that. The only thing missing from this description is your name. So I grabbed it, and I read through everything. And immediately, I realized that the Museum of Science could be a fantastic platform to take this initiative, take my dream, and make it a reality, to have engineering in every school, in every state by 2015, simply because we're ranked number one in the country as a science center, so whatever the Museum of Science does, like similarly to Harvard in the museum world, everybody notices. So you have a good platform to start with. And then the Museum of Science does not compete with anybody. Because even, of course, we don't compete with universities, so it's very easy to make partnerships with universities, but also we don't compete with museums. And the theory there is if we help Minnesota have a great science center, and you go to Minnesota and you have a good time, when you come to Boston, you go to our museum too. So we help each other, and we want museums to be great throughout the country because you don't only go to one museum like you go to one university as an undergraduate. You can go to as many museums as you want. So I thought it's a wonderful, powerful platform to take this initiative and make it national, and also do it in a holistic way because to change really the culture, to make technology understood by the general public, you need to affect schools, formal education, but also you need to affect the general public. So if we have a program where museums introduce technology and engineering for the general public, and then you have engineering in schools, both of them together would truly change the view of technology and the understanding of technology in the US. And at the beginning, I thought this would be a US pride sort of initiative. So museum opened the search October 2nd. Planning to close it in May. October 15th, we had signed contracts. I dropped my tenure, left Tufts, goodbye. I was at the museum. I was in shock for a couple of times because I think, what am I doing now? But I've been there now for 5 years. We started immediately the National Center for Technological Literacy. We raised about $60 million to to support both sides of the initiative from a number of sources, including the federal government, private individuals, corporations. And we do three things in the formal world, in the school world. We do advocacy and support. I do a lot of that myself, so I give talks very similar to the one today to influential groups, either think tanks or huge conferences, you know, 3,000 teachers or legislators or at the federal government level, to make the case why engineering should be part of the curriculum. And it's interesting because there are all these brilliant reports coming out of D.C., like the Gathering Storm, and all of them recommend you have to better fund math and science to support innovation, and the point they all miss is the connector between math, science, and innovation is engineering, and it's not part of the curriculum. So you can teach kids in many better ways how many legs a grasshopper has, and that is not going to affect innovation. There's no connection between in K-12 between math, science, and innovation. There are abstract topics. The kids say, why on earth am I learning this? It has nothing to do with my life. And then, of course, there's no innovation benefit, regardless how much money we keep pouring at it. So a lot of this advocacy is to educate the political world that, yes, math and science are important, and everybody talks about STEM, you know, STEM, but really it's S&M. You know, they leave the T and the E out. You know, so we have to convince them that the T and the E are as important as the S and the M in the STEM to make it all complete. So advocacy is the first function, along with support. For example, Minnesota, after a strong advocacy effort, just decided to include engineering in its standards. So we have a team of our staff that works with DOE people in Minnesota to introduce standards. And we do the same thing in Florida and in Alabama and in 42 states at some level. The second thing we do is curriculum. We have an extensive curriculum development effort, and we have a totally different take on how books should be. In science, we have storybooks for elementary schools. Imagine the fear of elementary school teachers if you tell them that along with the science that you don't want to teach, now you have to teach engineering. So instead of saying this is engineering, we have sugar-coated it by embedding engineering in some very cool stories with kids. Each book we have is a story of a child from a different part of the world, and she talks about her community and a challenge or an opportunity the community has and how an engineer solved the challenge or took advantage of the opportunity. So the little girl from India talks about quality of drinking water in her village and how an environmental engineer built a filtration system that saved the village. And the kids, with the teacher, built a filtration system, a simple one. So they get engaged in engineering through storytelling. And we have a middle school curriculum that's based on algebra, and a high school curriculum is storybooks for big kids. Our book is the stories of 32 cool engineers, real engineers, most of them from the Boston area, talk about the work they do, how they became engineers, and then we sneak in curriculum, which covers 100% of the engineering standards and 50% of the physics standards for the state. So that's our curriculum development effort. And the third thing we do is professional development for teachers, straight workshops, train the trainers, work with 42 states, so we have partners now in universities and museums throughout the country, so we train the trainers and then they do the work. We have a program where we bring in leadership from school districts and we reconfigure the way they offer things so they can fit engineering into the school district. So these are the three things we do. We are actively now, our curriculum is being pilot tested by about 250,000 children throughout the country, and we have started now publishing and selling some of the books. And a couple of things in closing. If you wonder what museums were doing for the No Child Left Behind initiative, before this, the only thing we used to do for the No Child Left Behind initiative is to make sure at the end of the day when the buses leave the museum, there are no children left behind. You know, that was pretty much the initiative. This is the first major initiative where museums are involved at the federal level and local level to improve education. And if you're wondering also what happened to that little girl that started all this, because remember, this whole thing started by me taking a wrong turn. There was no intention of being involved in that. Of course, she won first prize at the science fair. And that year, and what was wonderful is the five subsequent years, girls won first place. And girls never used to win first place at that school. Then she went on to high school, graduated with honors, and went to Haverford College in Pennsylvania, great liberal arts school. Haverford College, she got her bachelor's in a double major in biology and history, graduated with honors. Then she went to Tanzania. That was unexpected. She went to Tanzania and she started her own not-for-profit foundation where she fundraised and designed and built science laboratories for children. And this was early 90s. And now she just moved back last year. The foundation has grown in Tanzania and it's running on its own. She moved back and she's on her second or third year of international education PhD at Stanford University. So that's where she ended up, and was a good example because I thought she benefited from the accidental bumping into each other, and I certainly benefited as well because it totally changed my life's direction. So these are my comments, and if you want to if we have time for questions or anything.
What happened to the teacher?
Yes. I hope he's not on the internet watching me right now. actually, the teacher was a wonderful, wonderful teacher. My sense, and he was very caring of the kids, and I worked with him, and I didn't see any signs of sexism or anything, big signs. I think what happened was that he wanted to make sure that I have a great experience. My first experience with his class is a great experience. And for better or worse, he thought that these three boys would give me a better experience and a more rewarding experience that would ensure that I would stick around than Jen did. You know, of course, it was totally different than what he thought, but that was, that's I think, what it was. Because I worked with him, and he was, there was not a big issue, at least. I don't know, maybe, you know, you never know, but nothing blatant.
So, this was a fabulous conference.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I am a member of the engineering school at Harvard. And, you know, if you think that these attitudes do not come in, you know only too well for the benefit of everybody else.
Look at the history of the curricular review that Harvard conducted over the last couple of years. You know, technology was kind of in there, and then it was out of there, and then there was, you know, something about relevance to the real world, and then people rose up and said, no, it's knowledge for knowledge's sake, and, you know, we wound up more back in the 19th century mode than in the 21st century mode at the end of it, sad to say. And just a footnote on your thing, which you probably know, but as I say, given where I am, you know, Eliot's diffidence about engineering, of course, had in part to do with the fact that you did not get tenure at the Lawrence Scientific School, decamped to MIT, and it was from MIT that he was recruited back to be president of Harvard. But when he came back, he wanted to make Harvard the antithesis of MIT. He wanted it to be the pure.
I love it.
So this was
that's so, one more.
So still today, you know, there's this kind of platonic thing that we're fighting, where the highest things are things that are not even material. They're sort of purely mathematical. And then below those are the material world, but the natural world above the artificial world. And that old hierarchy, which has been with us for, you know, 2,500 years, you know, I sat in the faculty meetings last year listening to those curricular debates and say, we haven't gotten over it yet.
It's actually exciting to find one more piece of history about the bias. One of the challenges we have is that our curriculum, as you know, is really came out of the English curriculum, the English universities, you know, the Oxfords and the Cambridges. And again, there, that's probably the only other European country where, like you said, the least practical you are, the more value you're perceived to have. And then you have this whole food chain where the civil engineers that are really the ones that develop the world that we live, they are the pits,
and that's the story about the stuck toilet. That's what engineers
yes.
are equating. Yeah. So I'm sorry, I have to go off and meet a guy to talk about curricular reform. It's a fabulous talk. It's nice to see you.
You know, the whole image issue is a problem. First, if you look at TV shows, okay, you know, law, you used to be somewhere there, and then all these fabulous shows like The Practice and LA Law showed up, and law all of a sudden became, again, you know, a prominent field. Same with medicine. Okay, you have the ER. If you look at engineering, you know who is the only engineer that's popular in today's shows? Homer Simpson. Bart Simpson's dad. Can you name another one? No, there isn't, you know. So that's a problem. And if you think that's sort of shallow, and yes, it's TV, and what do they know? Think NASA, okay? I just joined the board at NASA simply to try to change the world there, because NASA is probably the most fabulous public engineering organization in the world. And they make unbelievable things. You know, if you think of what, you know, the things that take off here and make it to the moon or Mars or rendezvous in the middle of nowhere, you know. It's unbelievable, amazing. But, you know, NASA employs 15 engineers for each scientist. But they call themselves a science organization. And when the rover made it up to Mars, the press release came out and it said, a science miracle. You remember how they call it when something went wrong with the rover? An engineering error. It's a science miracle to make it up, an engineering error when something... So these are messages that stick in people's minds. And so when they stratify the science and engineering, engineering is somewhere there, and science or philosophy even, you know, it's way up, for better or worse. Yes.
Considering your latter comment about the teachers that you were talking about, what made you think that his remark had to do with more with the girl was a girl and not that she was mediocre students that you happened to mention?
I'm not sure what the way it is. I saw him how he interacted with girls for the next 4 years, and I didn't sense, you know, he was giving opportunities to the girls. And maybe it was because of my influence, maybe not, but I didn't sense, it wasn't something I would notice. It was the first and only time I noticed a bias with him.
But why did you think it had to do with her being female and not her being mediocre student?
Oh, in the beginning?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. It just struck me that a kid that had the courage, and maybe because I was naive and new at that, the first kid that ever came to me in my life to ask me, can you help me? He tried to dissuade me, and I connected it to this. Because I didn't know the other kids more than I knew her, and I made that connection. But it's interesting how you had never asked
that. Your connection went to the fact that she was a female and not to the fact that he happened to mention that she was a mediocre student.
Because I couldn't believe, based on the way she was keeping notes, she was interested. I just didn't think that this kid could be a mediocre student. It looked like a totally engaged. I saw mediocre students there. They were doing aeroplanes, or they were teasing each other, but she was totally intense. And so I couldn't believe that this kid could not be a good kid. And these are things happened in seconds. So it's very hard for me to play back now, God knows how many years. This was in 1987, you know, that happened.
So how did you get from flunking science and math in 10th grade?
Yeah, good question.
Going to Tufts.
I have a good, that's a good story. Okay, that's a good story. And I think we have a few minutes. So here, you want me to say it? No, let me just, you know, I can say it and then we're going to go. Here it goes. I used to be a boarding student because my parents were divorced. So my dad thought it was better, I would be better raised if I didn't stay with my mom and I was at the boarding school. So that was in fourth grade. So at ninth grade, after ninth grade, we had the option to either continue in boarding school. I went to Athens College, and some of you may know the school. It's the Phillips Academy of Greece, you know, whatever, the Exeter. At that point, it was all boys. Now it's co-ed. So I had the option either to stay at boarding school or become a day student. So my dad still didn't want me to become a day student. So I lobbied all his friends. It was a big marketing effort with my mom, his friends, pressure, this, that. Finally, he was convinced. So he let me out. And I was an okay student then.
But is your dad an engineer?
Yes, he was an engineer, civil engineer. So he lets me out. I start first semester as a day student, and I discover there are girls out there. Oh. First semester, flanked 4 courses. Not that I was doing anything with the girls, I just was not doing my work, you know? So it was math and physics. Actually, it was algebra, physics, English, and ancient Greek. Believe it or not, ancient Greek is a major discipline in Greece, as if you're going to meet Socrates and have a chat with him, you know. But in any case, it is. So I flunked 4 courses. And then there was panic, because if my dad saw the grades, he would throw me back into boarding school. So I went and begged his secretary in his office, because she would get the grades from the school. And I said, you cannot show the grades. And she said, I'll make a deal with you. If you, next semester, you get 4 A's in these 4 disciplines, I won't show him the report card. But if you don't, not only I'll show him the report card, but I'll tell him that you blackmailed me. What choice did I have? So I killed myself, and I ended up getting 4 A's, one of them in physics. And that hooked me with physics, because my physics teacher was so fabulous that I was like the pits in the class, and he appreciated my efforts, and he gave me the chance to become the best grade in the class. I had the best grade in the class, but he totally focused on me. He wanted to help me out. And then I liked physics. I thought, this is really cool. And I started doing projects, and that got me hooked with physics. And then, of course, I started doing well in math. And then when I came to Tufts, I had no idea what kind of engineer I was going to be. But I met my advisor, Lloyd Trefethen, who was a fabulous mentor and hooked me to fluid mechanics day one, actually, at the orientation section. I got hooked into fluid mechanics. So that's the school.
But that implies that it's more than the curriculum that's going to make.
Oh, the teacher.
Yeah.
The teacher is very important. By the way, I told my dad 5 years ago about this. He never knew.
My son is in systems engineering at University of Virginia. The person who led him there was Rich Vogel from your faculty. And I just want to say that the faculty members of the engineering schools are some of your best salespeople when it comes to K-12. And I just want to encourage you in that direction, especially around fellowships or whatever you wish, that we get them out there to help people, help young people understand this discipline, this multifaceted discipline. So I just want to...
You're absolutely right. And I would say even better ambassadors are the engineering students, because having a 19-year-old connecting with a middle school student is much easier than getting me or Rich Vogel to connect with a kid like that. And we did have a lot of programs with Tufts, and we have programs at the museum where we team students, young college students with middle school kids. And if you look at our book, it has a lot of young people in there. And the language we wrote, the high school book, is casual language, which you never find in a textbook. Because it's for high schoolers.
What's the title of the book?
Engineering the Future.
So, looking down your list of arguments, I find it interesting. I would make some of the same arguments about the work that we do around here, about its value in terms of project-based learning, understanding of the world around you, even if the world around you is on a two-dimensional screen, about making math and science and other disciplines relevant, and I can probably add some other ones. And one of the things that I work on and I'm very interested in is what universities in developing countries do, particularly vis-a-vis information and communication technologies, because I feel like these arguments are relevant to those universities. Mm-hmm. And what tends to happen if you go to an engineering school or computer science or you name the discipline, you find them working on highly theoretical problems that are going to get published in some journal in which a few people may read, and they're going to be eligible for some sort of prize or some such thing or academic recognition, but are not solving problems that are in the least bit relevant to their communities. And this goes to Harry's point to some extent about sort of the division between basic and applied research and sort of the appropriateness of dealing with real-world problems. But to me, I can think of nothing more challenging than dealing with the real world and its problems and using an educational platform to explore it, ideally solve problems that are valuable socially, but also in terms of the learning process and in terms of integrating and utilizing the many skill sets you need to come up with a complex technological or engineering solution to a real-world human-faced problem. And I don't know if hear your response to that, and also whether you, outreach or any interaction you have with other countries, especially in developing transition.
Couple of thoughts on that. The tenure process drives the system. Okay, I've gone through it, I've gotten tenure, and you got to publish in good journals, and good journals don't publish applied work. So if that's a rule, unless you change the rules, this is not going to change in universities. Bernie Gordon, who's one of our benefactors, both at Tufts University and at the Museum of Science, he's one of the most brilliant engineers I know. He runs Analogic, he invented the CAT scanner, that's amazing. I made a fetal monitor. He puts money on the table. He said, you can give me the whole faculty of Tufts Engineering, and they cannot finish a project as well as one of my engineers can. They're brilliant people on the faculty, but they're not, and I believe I wouldn't take a bet like that. I wouldn't put 50 people with one of Bernie's engineers, because I know they couldn't do it. It's a different skill set. And the problem is these are the people that teach the engineers that are supposed to be designing things. And that's why Bernie has invested millions of dollars in universities and MIT and Tufts and others to try to create engineers that could do this problem solving, because they're taught by people like me that have two patents, but really I haven't built anything that works. And I'm the one that teaches these kids. So how are they going to graduate and know how to build stuff? So that's one of the problems. On the other side, on the developing countries, it's easier to introduce engineering to Malaysia than to introduce it in Boston. And this is a fact, because we had In Malaysia, they learned about our program. They sent 15 people here to learn about it, and it's going to be one person's decision. And if one person decides Malaysia schools will have engineering, they'll have engineering. Here you have to go town by town in Massachusetts. The Department of Education cannot say you should have engineering. They can test it, and then it's up to its town to see how they're going to do it. But every town has its own curriculum. Every town makes its own decisions. It's local control, for better or worse. It has advantages, but has big problems. You cannot make quick, effective change in the United States unless you eliminate local control for schools. You cannot. Okay. So that's the problem instituting engineering here compared to other countries. There was something else in my mind, but I forgot. Let me come back.
I just have one more question. Museums of science, are they growing in number in around the world the way they seem to be here? Or are they growing here even? I mean, I have a perception that they are.
I'm glad you asked, because that reminded me of what I wanted to say, and it's connected. If you look at the world in the 80s, you don't have to go that far. The only place you could get your science fix, okay, in a weekend was the Museum of Science. Now you have Discovery Channel, History Channel, oh, God knows how many channels, okay? You have internet, you can find stuff out. So museums have to try a lot harder to remain relevant and attract people. That's why you have seen internationally a decline in the number of people that go to museums. That is topped by the fact that, what do kids do in their free time? Okay, they're happy in my basement versus going to the museum. Okay, we travel with the kids. They'd rather stay in the room because of the computer than go out to see a museum. Maybe my kids are different, but a lot of the parents I talk to have the same issues with the kids. So that's one part of the problem, that museums have to try harder to become relevant. The number of museums has not grown significantly, at least since I entered the field 5 years, but still there are lots of them, and they all have the same attendance problems. Here's the problem that's connected to the work you do. As the way kids learn has changed dramatically because of technology, because of internet, iPods, PDAs, museums and schools have not changed. So although the way kids absorb information and interact has changed dramatically, museums have stayed the same and schools have changed the same. So I'm looking for a few groups, probably similar to you, to take the leadership and start thinking of how do you transform the learning, the connectivity, the interaction in a museum environment to bring it closer to the way that the young people are learning today, who are going to be the parents of the kids tomorrow that will decide whether they're going to the museum or not. Okay, so it's not only for the business side of us, like protect and make sure we're survive, but also the museums offer a wonderful three-dimensional world. But my gut feeling is unless we connect it with the digital world, which is now second language for kids, then we're going to lose them. The museums will become irrelevant, and kids won't take advantage of the museums the way they could, simply because of that connection. And nobody's really looking into that. We're trying at the Museum of Science to do a few projects, but it's a major effort, because we have to redefine the whole way museums look and connect with people. But that's something some of you may want to think about, since it's your area.
I think we and some of our colleagues are, and I think we should take you up on your challenge. With that, please join me in thanking Jan.